Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial, and cfuv.uvic.ca in Shoutcast on the internet. That's a little bit from Jessica Peanut, something I took off the net with, you know, it's just an anti-war film and, you know, done with a montage of pictures and that's very good. We're sorry, Jessica Peanut. It's at pacificfreepress.com. That's my website, so you can check it out. Well, is America at the end of its imperial road? I mean, Chalmers Johnson, author and former agent of the government of the United States of America, thinks so. Johnson's newly released book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, completes his trilogy chronicling the end of days of America's century. It accompanies Blowback and The Sorrows of Empire. Welcome to the program, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, you can call me Chris if I can call you Chalmers.
Fine.
All right, Chalmers, your first book in the trilogy, now completed with Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, was Blowback.
Yes.
Can you explain where this term originated and what it means?
Yeah, it's a CIA term that first appeared in the after-action report on the CIA's first overthrow of a foreign legitimately elected government, namely that of Iran in 1953. The after-action report was just recently declassified. In it, the agency says, we're going to get some blowback from this. You may say that that's exactly what's going on in Iraq, and Iran today is still blowback from misconceived and bungled operation, basically to serve the interests of the British Petroleum Company. We accused Mohammad Mossadegh of being a communist, but the Pope would have fit the category better. It was just the British were irritated that he wanted a little bit more control over his own oil.
Well, how much now? I mean, today, I mean, that event in Iran, which the Iranians, I'm sure, remember very clearly, even if the American people don't, you know, largely.
It brought to power the Shah of Iran and established one of the most odiously repressive regimes in the post-war period, and, of course, led to the Iranian Revolution of 1979, bringing to power the Islamic fundamentalists of Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Arab nationalist movement of the early 50s, well, it actually started before that, but it started to blossom in the 50s in Egypt and in Iran. How much does that fear on the part of British Petroleum or the other major oil companies, how much does Arab nationalism play in the policies that we're seeing played out today?
Oh, well, certainly it plays a huge role in the sense that America's traditional position in the Middle East was rested on two pillars. One was Saudi Arabia and the creation of the Arabian American Oil Company in the 1930s and the exploitation of Saudi petroleum, which still remains the largest supply on Earth today. The second pillar was Iran, where we brought to power our puppet, the Shah of Iran, in 1953, and exploited him as long as we could until revolution overtook us. That the Iranian pillar is, of course, long gone, and we're never going to have, at least extremely unlikely, we're going to have very friendly relations with Iran ever again. The Saudi pillar collapsed after the first Gulf War, when the United States put American troops in Saudi Arabia, about as stupid an idea as anybody in Washington ever had, and it led just before the eve of the current war in Iraq, the Saudis had more or less restricted our use of their bases at Prince Sultan Air Base outside of Riyadh and other such places to such an extent that we moved out and used an air base in Qatar to launch the invasion of Iraq and the headquarters of Central Command.
Well, I recall those bases well, and it was in the media quite a bit that the United States military had created these so-called plug-in military bases, and they made it sound as if, well, the whole thing could be unplugged like a component and just sit there, you know, idly with nothing, and then the minute, you know, an urgent situation came, America would just come and plug in,
That was true, but that's the American empire. I mean, it's 737 American military bases in over 130 countries. That's according to the official Pentagon count. Once you add in the espionage bases, the bases in Britain that are disguised as Royal Air Force bases, the bases we dare not acknowledge because it would be too embarrassing to the countries that have allowed us to get there. It's probably up to 1,000. I doubt that anybody in the Pentagon knows the exact number.
Jeez, that's
amazing. But it's one big empire.
Well, the American administration came out just the other day. They were criticizing China and saying, "Well, look, the Chinese have given up. They've given us numbers of their military spending. It's going up, but we think that it doesn't cover all of the money that they are spending on defense." Now, I know that you're an expert in the Orient, an expert in Japan, and in China.
We say rather than expert.
An expert is somebody who can't be wrong, because then he wouldn't be an expert anymore.
Right, I'm a specialist.
Okay, well then now. Now, what about this? Now, China's military spending.
We can't possibly trust the Pentagon on a thing like this. We don't know the size of the Chinese defense budget any more than they know, or for that matter, even the American Congress knows the size of the American defense budget, in that 40% of the official Defense Department appropriations is black. That is, it's secret and can only be seen by military officers and a few selected flunkies in the Congress. And then beyond that, they disguise it immensely, in that the spending by the United States on its military establishment goes well beyond the official Department of Defense appropriation. Atomic weapons are in the Department of Energy. Veterans and recuperation of our wounded from Iraq, that's in the Department of Veterans Affairs. Foreign military aid is in the Department of State. Actual defense of the United States is the Department of Homeland Security. One thing after another, it adds up to spending on the military establishment by the United States that is larger than all other military spending appropriations of every other country on Earth combined.
And the largest single item in America's budget as well.
Right, and I mean, it's about 40% on every tax dollar right
Amazing.
Now is going for the military. The country is increasingly dependent on the military-industrial complex, on what in my new book, Nemesis, I call military Keynesianism, and it's out of control. But what I'd say is, for us to sit around and talk about how we can't discern our way through the Chinese defense budget is about as hypocritical as you can get.
Well, John Maynard Keynes, of course, being the economics whiz of the last century. Well, you know, in your book, I mean, there was something interesting in the news the other day. I mean, interesting in a strange way. It was a sort of a CNN report. But if you recall that this rather bizarre love triangle that happened at NASA, the space agency down there. Well, the man involved in this love triangle was sent packing out of NASA and back back to the Navy. So, I mean, these are military functionaries that are interchangeable at NASA. And in your book, again, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, you mention, well, space, of course, that is the ultimate imperialism.
Well, it is also the ultimate boondoggle. I mean, most of this stuff is technologically worthless. We can demonstrate, I try to in the book, that it simply doesn't work, that it's beyond the laws of physics to do the sorts of things they have in mind. But nobody actually cares. It's the purpose is to service the military-industrial complex, to provide jobs for people who work in it. Places like Boeing and Lockheed Martin and outfits like that are extremely influential in our society. They don't much care whether the investment in space war works or not. The important thing about it is that it's really costly.
And it just keeps going. It's self-perpetuating.
But you ask about blowback. Blowback is a term used by the CIA that basically obviously means retaliation for things done that we have done secretly abroad against any number of countries now around the world. It would be easier to name those that don't hate us for things that we have done. But the important point is things that we've done around the world that were kept totally secret from the American public. So that when the retaliation comes, as, for example, on September 11th, 2001, they're completely unable to put it in context, to see cause and effect, and to lash out against alleged perpetrators in remarkably unintelligent ways, and to sit still for questions of the sort that George Bush has posed, why do they hate us?
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca on the internet. I'm speaking tonight with Chalmers Johnson, and Chalmers is the author of Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, third in a trilogy published as the, what is it, the America Empire Project?
Yes.
And and Chalmers is described in this book as the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute as well. And I saw something interesting today, Chalmers, in the papers, that yesterday Japan's agriculture minister, and he was also their minister of fisheries, who was involved in a scandal, committed suicide. And the Japanese are coming close to another general election in a couple of months' time. Where does Japan play in America's empirical role today in the world?
Well, if Tony Blair is our poodle, then their prime minister is our Cocker Spaniel. Mm-hmm. It's a completely imperialist relationship. We have 91 American military bases in all of Japan.
91?
37 of them are in the most southerly island, Okinawa, which is the poorest prefecture in Japan. It has always been discriminated against. It is it's not accidental that that's where the American military bases are, in order to not infuriate the politically influential citizens of the mainland of Honshu and the other main islands. It acquiesces in virtually everything we do or say, and is a active member of the American Empire around the world. This is dangerous because Japan is a one-party state, has been since 1955. There's been they keep calling themselves democratic, and there may be a sense of democracy only in the broadest sense that public opinion does in some inchoate way influence Japanese policy. But to say that there is any form of serious accountability is to push it very, very far. And indeed right now, Mr. Abe, the current prime minister, is a distinct rightist who is definitely trying to rewrite history, rewrite Japanese war crimes during World War II and things of this sort. It is not a very happy picture. Not very well reported on in our particularly sorry press in the United States.
Yeah, well, I'll second that. And what about the move by previous administrations in Japan and the current one to rewrite the so-called Article 7 on Japan's self-defense?
It's Article 9.
Oh,
it's well on its way. That is certainly the Abe government and the people around Mr. Abe want to use this opportunity to rewrite the peace constitution. I think this is an extremely serious development in this sense. It's long been argued that Japan didn't apologize for World War II, as, for example, the Germans did. I don't think that's true. I first came to Japan in 1953 and have been working there for the rest of my life. I believe that in a certain sense, Article 9, renouncing war or maintenance of preparations for war, was the Japanese apology. It was the way of saying to the rest of East Asia, never again. We recognize what we did in China, Korea, Southeast Asia, even Australia during World War II, and we want to make it understood that this will not happen again because we're never going to go to war again. Well, to renounce this element of the Constitution, something that I'm sorry to say the Americans have been pushing Japan to do for years now, even though the origins of this clause in the Constitution came from the American occupation of Japan, that to renounce this is to renounce the apology. And that's causing enormous friction in the rest of East Asia, friction that I don't think anybody understands, apparently even the Japanese themselves, what they're getting into. China is today the world's fastest growing economy. Korea is an extremely rich and successful society that has nothing but loathing for their former Japanese overlords. But it's not just China and Korea. It includes Hong Kong. It includes Southeast Asia. The Japanese are asking for trouble. The Americans are asking for equally great trouble by going along with it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, when you talk about constitution shredding now, I mean, the United States is the mother of all constitutional shredders now.
Well, I've tried to describe that in Nemesis. That's why I mean my subtitle. It's not just a way to sell books, The Last Days of the American Republic. Unless something quite fortuitous and unexpected occurs, I'm sorry to say, that is the way we're going.
Well, in reading your book, I mean, I was amazed at, many of the ways that the laws have been ignored or just overridden, or,
absolutely.
And nobody's saying anything, but nothing is more striking than the so-called unitary executive
unitary
theory
executive
of the president.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the American public is not, that is, they're quite passive. They're not playing the active citizen role, exercising oversight on the government. They often can't because they can't get the information. It's either secret or the media hides it. But nonetheless, last November, they did elect the opposition party with a clear understanding that the country was going in the wrong direction, that the war in Iraq was a disaster and had to be stopped. But the head of the opposition party, the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, when offered, why don't you impeach the president? That is, after all, our constitutional way to deal with an extremely unsatisfactory political leader and vice president. Both, there's ample evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors, as the Constitution says, is the basis for impeachment. She said impeachment is off the table. Well, I want to say if impeachment is off the table, democracy might be off the table, too.
Yeah, I don't understand why I've talked to many people on this issue, you know, many Americans on this issue, but why the impeachment process doesn't have
exactly
some kind of automatically triggering mechanism.
Why the
mechanism.
Congress is not using the power of the purse to bring the war to an end when 75% of the American public, in one poll after another, conservative to quite left, have said they want out. They don't like it. The war was a mistake. They've been lied to, and it's a disaster.
And so why do you believe they don't come out? This is bleeding America white.
They refuse to acknowledge. They're in denial of the trouble we're in. There's almost no discussion of, say, a radical but logical procedure to undertake, and that is start dismantling the empire. It's useless to us. We don't need 737 American military bases around the world. Start doing it right now. The British only avoided becoming a tyranny domestically as a result, after World War II, of deciding to finally dismantle their empire. We're headed in the direction of the old Roman Empire, namely military dictatorship.
Well, you compare some of the things that George Bush is doing today to the Roman Empire and Julius Caesar. And how is that an apt comparison? I would have thought Caligula would have been more...
Well, Caligula would have been a better one, yes. I mean, you may well say that the first Roman Emperor, Augustus, though it was certainly no pretense of democracy any longer, he ruled for life, was a vaguely effective governor. But the successors, my God, were Tiberius, Caligula, drooling idiot Claudius, and then Nero. Whatever you think of this, I guarantee you this is not good government.
Well, and this is the other thing, all of these precedent-setting moves that Bush has made, whoever succeeds him, and God knows it doesn't look like a very promising
group
so far. But
the political system is failing.
But you know, what it is that makes him the Julius Caesar, it strikes me by reading your book, and again, it's Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic by Chalmers Johnson, is his insistence on being the war president. This is sort of like saying, well, I've got unlimited power now because
yes,
I'm the war president, and he decides what the war is, when the war ends. You know, I mean, it's all in the mouth of George Bush now.
The argument I'm trying to make is that the root cause of this is imperialism. The inescapable accompaniment of imperialism is militarism. It is the military establishment that creates the empire, that polices it, that expands it, and that standing armies. Militarism is not defense of the country. It's a way of life. It's the military-industrial complex. It's the kind of base structure that we have around the world today. That's lunatically expensive. It ultimately leads to imperial overstretch, bankruptcy, the kinds of things that led the Roman Republic to succumb to the Roman Empire, so-called. The Roman Republic is an important precedent because so much of the United States was modeled on it by the authors of the Constitution in the late 18th century, and the prognosis is not good.
Well, I mean, many people have spoken, and it's almost cliche nowadays, that when they look at the situation the United States is in today, they quote, what's his name now? Eisenhower.
Yes, of course.
The industrial, right. Industrial complex.
His great warning. Of course, the first warning came from George Washington, the first president,
who said
famously, standing armies are the enemy of liberty, and they are the particular enemy of Republican liberty.
Only if we had the founders today. And, you know, the quote that really sums it up for me is by George W. Bush's father, when he gleefully rubbed his hands together and said, thank God we've gotten over the Vietnam syndrome. And,
exactly.
And that was the beginning. Well, sadly, Chalmers, we're out of time. But I know that we could cover a lot more ground, and I do hope that you'll consider coming on sometime in the future. Again, Chalmers Johnson's third book in the trilogy, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, is out. And your publishers, Chalmers, sent me copies, but they're at the courier. I couldn't get them today. But next week, for you loyal listeners, I'll be giving away a couple copies of Chalmers Johnson's book, Nemesis.
Well, I'm glad that Metropolitan Books did that. Thank you very much for inviting me on your program.
Well, my great pleasure, and I hope we do get a chance to talk again. And I also want to thank, of course, Janine Bancroft for coming on, and Zoe Blunt, and Ted Harluck, and all the people up here at the station that make things whir and spin and keep going week in and week out. And that's it for me until the next time. But do stick around for jazz. That's coming right up with Arnold and Rhythmining. Until the next time.